On this episode, the founders of Radio Survivor renew their vows and slay a pernicious cliche.
Said, you know, radio, the medium that will not die. And the reporter said, what's going to kill radio? I mean, I wanted to write to this guy and say, what do you want to kill radio for?
And we attack the argument that radio has to become obsolete.
I think there's sort of this false idea that media is evolving. So we have radio, and then that's going to get replaced by television, and then that's going to get replaced by the computer, which is going to get replaced by whatever, the cloud. You know, that's not actually happening.
Later on the show, Eric will share his findings on horror film podcasts.
There's always been something that has appealed to me about any time they can take a horror film and use it to have that discussion of what is a human being and what is a man.
I listened to a lot of them, and it was fun.
And we revisit an enduring question about podcasting.
When to stop and why you're doing it, I think, is the sum total of what we revisit.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. This is the show about radio that matters, about great radio and the people who make it and the people who enjoy it. And this is the adjunct to the website radiosurvivor.com. We should really be telling you. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I am one of your hosts and producers.
And my name is Eric Klein. I'm a co-host and a co-producer.
And so I had a great opportunity to hang out with the co-founders of radiosurvivor.com as we celebrate more than 6 years on the interwebs. I was down in San Francisco where Jennifer Waits and Matthew Lassar, my co-founders, they live. And we went over to Matthew's house to record our first segment all together.
Yes, you and Matthew and Jennifer started the conversation by talking about founding Radio Survivor, why it was important to do the work, and why you came together to do it. And the conversation developed into a discussion of where you think it's heading.
With me is Matthew Lassar.
Hello.
And Jennifer Waits.
Hello.
So I was able to be down here in San Francisco for the weekend, and luckily Jennifer and Matthew could make time for this podcast recording out of their busy schedules, and we could be all together for the first time on the show.
This is the first time we've ever been together, the three of us, for a radio show, and it's the second time that we've ever been physically together.
All three of us, yes.
All three of us. Over 6 years.
I know. It's kind of hard to believe because we get sort of used to our virtual relationship. So it's, I know it's only been twice that we've all been together, but it seems like more.
Well, we've been communicating with each other on a daily and almost weekly basis. Often a weekly basis for 6 years.
So. Yeah. And I thought it would be wonderful to talk a little bit about the origin story for what it is we do, for this thing we call Radio Survivor. Because I don't know that we've ever really written about it in any coherent sort of way. And I think, people, you know, you can sort of receive Radio Survivor. You look at it on the web and you can kind of understand what it is. You can listen to the podcast and sort of understand what it is. But the background story is kind of lost.
Yes. It's best to tell it before we, especially I, forget it.
And Matthew, I said this a little bit on the very first edition. I gave a little bit of setup, but not a lot. And it was really your idea.
Well, I think it was all of our ideas, but the train of conversation begins as follows. I was writing for Ars Technica, which is a great big online journal, and I was a regular daily reporter for them, and I really loved writing for Ars Technica, and I really loved writing for working with the people I worked with there. But there was something missing, which was that I wrote about net neutrality and antitrust and white space broadband and all these broadband speed issues and things like that. I never wrote about any technology that I really loved, and the thing that I love of most is radio. I, as you both know, I've written two books about the Pacifica Radio Network, and I love radio. And frankly, at Ars Technica, radio was kind of passé. I would occasionally get to write about something like AM radio or something like that, and we'd get comments like, AM radio, does that still exist? And then somebody else would write, that interferes with my iPad. or something, you know, people would say things like that. And I realized I really wanted to write about radio, and but I didn't want to write for one of these great big sites, these industry sites, which present themselves as the voice of the industry. You know, we're the voice of the industry. I wanted to write from the perspective of users and of especially people who are trying to keep locally based, community based radio alive. And you were interviewing me on your radio, your community radio show.
Yeah, called Media Geek.
Media Geek. And I said, let's start something. And you said, I know somebody who's really into this stuff. Jennifer Wakes.
Well, you know, the first time, actually, so you first approached me even a few years earlier.
Right.
So I'm going to think it's in the neighborhood of 2006.
Oh, I'm glad we're talking, because I completely forgot this.
And you said, you know, I'm doing, and at that point, I don't even think you were writing for Ars regularly. You had been writing a little bit, but yes, you were writing a website called Lazar's Letter on the FCC.
Yeah, very modest title.
And I was a fan and a reader, often citing it on my blog, Media Geek. And John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, who has been a guest on the show and a sometimes collaborator with us, he was also a fan of it. And we would talk about it. And you got a hold of me. You sent me an email and you said, you know, you're doing this Media Geek thing, and I'm sure you're not getting the kind of traffic you'd like and traction. And I'm doing this Lazar's Letter, and I'm not getting what I'd like. We should join forces. And I said, no. And so this must have been even like earlier than that, because I was still under the illusion that I might finish my PhD in communication.
Oh, I see.
And I was like, well, I'm already too distracted. I'm already not getting anything done. And I'm making this last failed pitch to do this. So I'm not sure that I can make that kind of commitment. And you were like, well, I'm sorry, you know, but, you know, I don't know if I'll keep up. I don't know if I can keep doing this in any event. And if you change your mind, let me know. And then in 2009, you emailed me and said, you know, I think we should do this. You know, I know I talked to you a few years ago, but I think now is the time. And I said, okay, let's talk. By that point, I had officially thrown in the towel.
Oh, okay.
I had officially thrown in the towel. I was still doing the Media Geek show. I was still doing my own blogs. I had changed jobs. I'd moved from Urbana-Champaign, Illinois to Chicago. And I was feeling like your proposition, which was together we will have more of an impact than we will separately. And I said, I knew you were right. I knew fundamentally you were right. And that's so what I want to talk with you. And you called. And so we talked for the first time ever on the phone.
I think.
And then you said, you know, but I think it needs to be more than just the two of us. And I said, right. And I didn't actually know Jennifer.
You didn't know her?
I didn't know Jennifer. Do you remember, Jennifer, how you came onto my radar?
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. So starting in 2008, I started writing about college radio on my blog, Spinning Indie. And pretty much from the beginning, I started visiting radio stations around the country. And I visited WNUR at Northwestern and wrote up a piece about it. And I think I had probably written about you before or quoted you. I think I knew about you somehow, but I didn't know you were...
Only because of the students.
...connected to the station.
Yeah. So we had a weekly meeting, which we always had, with the students. I was the advisor to the station at that time. Students said, oh, it was really cool. We got written up on this cool blog called Spinning Indie. And, you know, this really cool woman came through and interviewed us and took pictures. And you talked to... Oh, what is his name? I mean, you'll pull it up. But the student's general manager at the time was a really, really great, great guy. And I'm like, oh, really cool. I'm so sorry I missed it. So I looked it up, and I knew of you. And I think I did ask you to be on my show but that was it. And that was how you came on my radar.
Taylor Deere.
Taylor is a very very great student manager. We had a sequence of them, but he was great. And so when you talked to me, I'd recently learned about Jennifer. I'd recently learned about her site, and I started reading it religiously. And I thought to my, and you would, so when you said we need to find somebody else, you had said, you know, you'd mentioned some names. I was like, well, I've tried to work with so-and-so before, and he doesn't really have the time and whatever else. I thought, Jennifer.
Yes. Yeah, and you pointed the site to me, and I thought, yeah.
Like, there's the...
There's somebody crazy enough to...
Yeah.
Well, it was your passion.
No, it was another lunatic like us.
Yeah. I know.
When you put it that way.
Yeah. And so then you agreed. You said, yeah.
Yeah. I'd been writing about radio for a short period of time, but was really excited about it. And, I mean, in my case, I realized that nobody was covering the culture of college radio. So it really had become my mission to just write about what was going on in college radio, because I was shocked, completely shocked, that nobody in popular press was talking about college radio. Hardly anybody in academic world was writing about college radio. And I'd had this desire to be writing and blogging more. And it was the one area where it was this wide open space that was, you know, desperately in need of coverage. So I was excited to join up with you guys and start this revolution.
Why did you say yes?
Well, I'm glad you said yes.
Yes. But these two guys you don't even know, these two crazy radio guys out of the blue are like, so we want to start a new project.
Well, and I continued spinning indie.
Yes.
You know, I wasn't ready to shelve that. And I still have spinning indie, but I'm actually, the only time I'm posting there now is sort of promoting my radio station tours that are now living on Radio Survivor. But I kept it going, you know, as an active site for a long time because it was important to me to maintain that identity. But after a while, I realized that we were, you know, as a group, we were getting a lot more attention than we were separately.
Well, that was the idea originally. I mean, I understood that with a subject like radio, which in 2009 was, you know, a very contested subject. I mean, basically, I don't know if you just saw one of the posts I did. Bloomberg recently referred to radio as the cockroach of media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the kind of coverage radio gets at this point. I realized that if I was going to write about this, I would have to write about it with other people. One of the rules of thumb in blogging is you're better off blogging with other people than you are blogging by yourself. It really is one of these moments when you know, you magnify yourself by being, you know, with other people. So, you know, I said okay. And I started a WordPress site on Bluehost. I think the two of you were a little surprised, you know. I mean, I just sort of, you know, made this thing happen, and then we posted something about Low Power FM. Mm-hmm. We posted something about Mike Doyle at a hearing, Congressman Mike Doyle at a hearing. Right. And the next thing you know, we were all writing for Radio Survivor.
Yeah. And, you know, I was still sort of keeping up that other identity as Media Geek a little bit, although I decided that I would no longer write about radio there.
Yes.
Because I would also do things about net neutrality and video and photo. And I had the radio show, right, which I did from 2002 to 2009, which was a weekly show about independent media, a lot about radio, but not exclusively.
Yes.
I had started at WEFT in Champaign-Urbana, community radio station there, and they kept playing it even after I left, which was a really rare thing. A lot of community stations, you know, really want to have only local programming
right.
for good reasons. And I was very lucky that they kept playing it. And then when I moved to Northwestern University, when I was up in Chicago, the students were delighted to give me a half hour spot. And it was up to them. I was an advisor, so they could have very well told me to pack, you know, to say, get in line, mister. But they really were interested in having the show. And in that time, I started distributing it to other stations. So I had about 12 affiliates, almost all Low Power FM stations, along with two community stations in Canada, one in Halifax, Nova Scotia, who played it at 2 a.m. And I've been producing, you know, so was still producing that show. So I was kind of keeping up the identity. But I quit in 2009 at the end because Radio Survivor, my job, which was rather energy consumptive and everything else, became too much. And I was burned out.
Yes.
And I was a lot of burned out on Media Geek because I did a lot of like tracking legislation. You know, where is this net neutrality thing going, or where is this, you know, whatever? And that sucks.
Yeah.
I really got tired of trying to keep up on a lot of these things. And just the weekly grind of trying to find guests on my own primarily and everything finally got to me, and I quit it. Which allowed me to put more time into Radio Survivor instead. And yeah, I mean, you know, when I look back, if I look in archive.org in the Wayback Machine, it's great to look at our great sort of bare bones like website, you know, because it's just the theme.
Right.
That it comes when you install WordPress.
Right.
And
it was next to nothing.
Yeah. But it worked. But so I guess so, Matthew, you know, I'm going to put you on the spot, but I'll put Jennifer on the spot and you can put me on the spot. All right. So what is it that you hoped to accomplish, and how has that changed in the intervening 6 years?
Well, I always knew that when I started, when I initiated Radio Survivor, that it would wind up being something different than what I envisioned it as. I have always wanted Radio Survivor to be a very participatory experience, with lots of people commenting and lots of people posting and lots of people involved in an ongoing civil conversation about college radio, community radio, a radio as it is defined and being defined and redefined over the years. And we live in a time right now when there are all kinds of things that are called radio. You know, I was born in 1954, and in 1963, 1969, there was only one thing that was called radio. That was analog AM/FM radio. Now, you know, there's, you know, Pandora, there's Spotify, there's all these things that are called radio. At first, I was resistant to calling them radio, but now I've just basically gone along with people who want to call it radio. They want to call it radio. My focus has always been, and the direction I've always wanted Radio Survivor to go, is in asking, how does this empower local groups of people in their immediate neighborhoods, in their immediate cities, in their immediate regions, to communicate with each other and share things with each other on a real-time audio basis? Because I really believe that that's a really important thing, and that it's something that's really socially good, and it's been something that has been socially good for people throughout most of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my big thing is basically on an ongoing basis exploring how that's manifesting itself on a daily basis for people here and all over the world. At this point, I just want to briefly mention something. We cover radio all over the world at Radio Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't just cover it here in the United States. We cover it in Africa. We cover it in India. We cover it in the Middle East. We cover it in Europe. We particularly cover a lot of it in the United Kingdom and in Canada. And we believe in global, you know, in locally based radio all around the world and communicating with each other all around the world. So that's the way I've always wanted it to be. Frankly, I've never felt like we have gotten as much participation as I wanted to get.
Sure.
You know, we have worked very, very hard to get other people to write for Radio Survivor, to share Radio Survivor's resources with other people. And I want us to do that even more. So on one level, in terms of the three of us covering these things, I think we've been a big success in terms of growing and becoming more sustainable. I still think we have a long way to go.
And I want to say that we're very grateful to have brought on board Eric Klein.
Yeah.
With this podcast.
Fantastic.
Without him, we wouldn't have it.
No.
Without his help and his influence, his thoughts, and him poking me a little bit.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be doing it. Yes. He's an absolutely essential member of the team here at Radio Survivor now. And we're so absolutely grateful that we were able to bring him on board, because he came to us with lots of great experience at KPFA in Berkeley, at Free Speech Radio News. And he also has been a podcast producer himself, working on a lot of different projects. So I do want to make sure he is duly recognized. He knows that we're so grateful for him coming on board. So Jennifer, I think you talked a little bit about why you started Spinning Indie, and a little bit about, you know, coming on board with Radio Survivor. So, I mean, has what you hope to do changed in the time, or has your perspective changed, or, you know, the sense of possibility, has that changed in this intervening 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still doing a lot of what I set out to do, which is evangelizing college radio and sharing stories about stations that don't get written about. I think, even though I said college radio doesn't get covered in the media, it sometimes does, but it's often the same stations over and over again, you know, prominent stations that might be in larger cities. So I do think I'm continuing to write about a wide array of college radio stations all over the country. And I write about other things on Radio Survivor too, like low power FM, international stories, like Matthew mentioned. But also, you know, I have a deep love for popular culture, and that's what my master's degree is in. I'm one of the few people in the world with a master's in popular culture studies.
Right.
And, you know, I love writing about television and things besides radio. So that's been something I've enjoyed on Radio Survivor, looking at connections between radio and popular culture. Like when there's a radio storyline on a TV show, like Under the Dome, you know, I like writing about those moments. I also have been really happy to kind of embrace my love for academia. I'm sort of a part-time academic. I dropped out of my PhD program, but I still have an interest in academic writing. So I was really excited when we connected with Brian Fatteau, and now he writes pieces for Radio Survivor about radio studies and academics that are covering the world of radio. And it's been really gratifying kind of finding this community of radio academics, because there's sort of a renaissance going on right now in radio studies and sound studies. So I've been happy that Radio Survivor has been able to provide a platform for writing about those topics too, because I think that's really fascinating. And there's still more areas that I wish we could do more of, like radio art. The exciting thing about Radio Survivor is that I've always thought about it as a way to look at the world through the lens of radio. And so that means you can write about television. You could write about a really weird art exhibit that's incorporating radio signals. It means you can write about things that are going on in Africa involving protest movements and getting information out to citizens about human rights violations and the importance of community radio to connect people in dangerous situations or during disaster. So, you know, when I tell people, friends or family, when they ask, oh, what do you write about? I write about radio. I think most people think of that as being a much narrower thing than it actually is. You know, if you say that I'm writing about radio because I'm looking at the world through the lens of radio, it really opens things up.
Why is that important? So, I mean, you know, so Matthew sort of presaged a little bit, you know, Bloomberg referred to radio as a cockroach. Never mind the fact that currently all major research indicates that 300 million people in the United States listen to radio every week.
Well, when Bloomberg said that, what they meant was that
it survives.
It's survivability.
Yeah, right. I get it. It's not giving credit.
It's kind of pejorative.
It's pejorative. You know,
there's a lot of articles like this in the mainstream press. I mean, there's another article I ran into, said, you know, radio, the medium that will not die. I mean, literally, it said, and the reporter said, what's going to kill radio? I mean, I wanted to write to this guy and say, what do you want to kill radio for? Why is this?
Why? Yeah, well, I mean, there's the question. Why do we want to kill radio? Not we, but why is that one of the narratives?
Well, one of the things that I find really disturbing about those kind of those kind of expressions is that, you know, there is a real tendency towards the personalization of media now, which is basically, you know, what I call cubicle media, where, you know, in Pandora, nobody listens to the same Pandora. Almost nobody listens to the same Pandora. Basically, you're all just listening to your own individual channels. I think that there is really something to be said for all of us moving through time and listening to not exactly the same thing, but in many instances, communities of people listening to the same thing and respond to that and dialoguing with it, which is the experience of electronic media for much of the 20th century.
I think there's sort of this false idea that media is evolving, you know, that there's an evolution of forms of media. So we have radio, and then that's going to get replaced by television, and then that's going to get replaced by the computer, which is going to get replaced by whatever, the cloud. But it doesn't mean that everything, if you are actually evolving and replacing, you know, that's not actually happening.
You're right. Absolutely.
And it shouldn't denigrate the things that were invented prior, because they all have their own inherent value. You know, like people talk about radio as being much more personal and personalized than TV. There's something about having this disembodied voice without an image that is very intimate.
Well, one of the things that's important about radio is that when radio emerged, when broadcast radio emerged in the 1920s, it was glommed onto by almost every place in the world as a nation-building experience. There's India, Mexico, Canada, the United States, certainly the United Kingdom. Almost every place where radio became popular, it was regulated by regulators who saw it as part of the evolution of the national story of that particular place. This was certainly the case in the United Kingdom. It was unquestionably the case in India. And it was, for Herbert Hoover here in the United States, it was also the case. When Herbert Hoover, who was the first regulator of radio, made it very clear that this was something that would have to be publicly controlled, that would have to be publicly thought about. And so that radio came into the world and almost instantly became part of national identity, part of, became part of the story of national identity. You can't say that about any of these new technologies. You can't say that Pandora or Spotify or any of these things are part of the national story of anything, because they came much later. And in a sense, they are all in revolt to some degree against that way of thinking about electronic media. And as you probably know, I'm writing a book called Radio 2.0, Uploading the First Broadcast Medium. That manuscript has been accepted by my publisher.
Congratulations.
And it talks a lot about this, and it talks about how do we get back to this idea of radio in the 2.0 era as part of our identity, as part of what brings us together as peoples. And that's going to be a very difficult and complicated road for radio, but it's one of the things that I think I want Radio Survivor to explore on an ongoing basis. I should also say that I've learned so much from the two of you. About,
likewise.
I wrote two books about the Pacifica Network and radio in general, and my God, I wish I'd met you two before I'd written those books. Those books would be so different if I had not. You know, I've learned so much from the two of you about radio.
Likewise.
So I think this has really been a really beneficial collaboration, and now with Eric, on board
his own.
I just want to say to the microphone, you who are listening to this, we want your stuff, we want your input.
Yeah, because, I mean, people do still love radio. And here's the thing. I think we don't have to denigrate Pandora or Spotify or SiriusXM to love radio. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the inverse is true. The mirror image is true. Just, we don't have to denigrate radio or trash it, we don't have to have this sort of so-called creative destruction in order to also have Pandora and Spotify. We don't have to destroy radio in order to have these things. In fact, that would probably be not in anyone's best interest, which we argue frequently about how radio serves in national emergencies or serves when there's a natural disaster. If you hear, in the Midwest and you hear the tornado sirens, everyone has the same instinct. Turn on the radio.
Right.
That's what I'm going to find out is going on. And I think that's the same sort of thing everywhere, is that, well, what's going on? Oh, I can turn on the radio and now I'll know. And that's not going away yet. And that's not the only reason to have radio. You've just outlined both of you, I think, dozens of reasons.
Well, and to back up too, like if you're an FCC licensed station, that's part of your mandate that you have to air emergency alerts. You have to have a plan. It's part of what stations are supposed to do. And I remember being terrified doing college radio in the Midwest, and we had our weather radio, and I was always terrified that there was going to be a tornado warning because, we were supposed to stay in the station, to provide information. But well, that's now, just what you do.
Of course, now the EAS is automated, so it will take over.
Right.
I mean, whether you have someone there or not, which was designed around the fact that there's no longer human beings at so many radio stations. It was designed directly in response to that. It's certainly when I was at WNUR in Northwestern, we had a very active EAS, and I had been at the station many times when just a very severe thunderstorm alert would set it off. Because they're going to have flash flooding, because there's going to be lightning. And, of course, we were right on the shores of Lake Michigan, which, you know, because of waves and things like that, we had to have alerts. I've been in when I was at WFT in Champaign-Urbana, I've been there when there were tornado alerts. And, yeah, your station, you go on the air, and you convey that information. And it's set up to be very fail-safe. Right. I mean, there's a lot of coordination and engineering went into the design of the AAS system. That was the FCC's doing.
Right.
And why we've talked about why you can't run the fake alerts.
Right.
But so yes. kind of bringing this around then, my next question is, what do you want to see happen next with what we do at Radio Survivor? You know, what is it? Kind of you hope we can accomplish knowing what we know now, right? Knowing kind of what the sort of what we know about readership at this point and interest and how even radio as a medium has evolved in just 6 years.
I mentioned I'd like to explore different topics on the site more. I'd really like to write more about radio art and continue with the college radio coverage. And
I really want to reach out as much as I can over the next year to community-based radio stations around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I write a lot about India, Africa. I really want to explore how we can extend that kind of coverage and communicate with community radio stations everywhere, especially in rural places where they're broadcasting to people who speak many different languages. There's a radio station in India that I just wrote about that's right next to the Brahmaputra River that broadcasts to people in 5 different languages, mm-hmm. none of which are Hindi.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to communicate with these radio stations. They don't, because of internet access, they don't usually have websites. They're certainly not streaming. They certainly don't speak English. And so it's really interesting to write about them and try and figure out what they're trying to do. But the thing that I really want the most is I want to see more people participating in Radio Survivor than the 3 of us.
Mm-hmm.
Or the 4 of us at this point. I want to see more guest contributors. I want to see more commenters. I would like us to experiment with forums if we can figure that out and really get participation. The more input that we're getting from our readers, the better I feel. I also think that we need to focus on reminding our listeners that we are endeavoring to become a completely non-commercial,
right,
non-affiliate sponsored, yes, blog through our Patreon campaign. I was thrilled when we got rid of our Google ads.
Yeah.
And we no longer have any affiliate ads. And I can't wait until we get rid of our Amazon ads for a variety of reasons, among them that article in the New York Times that came out. I want us to be a completely non-commercial service because I believe in non-commerciality. I believe in the original vision of Lewis Hill, who was the founder of the Pacifica Radio Network, of a commercial-free broadcasting organization, because it really affects content in all kinds of direct and insidious ways, and I believe in that principle. So I'm making a pitch here for people to contribute just $1 a month to our Patreon campaign so that we can reach those goals.
To me, the biggest pain of doing Radio Survivor is the increasing awareness every month and every year of the stories we don't have the resources to do justice to. How reporting is, much of the reporting in the sort of shoe leather sort of way, is that bridge too far when you also have a job or a family or a job and a family or other businesses and other things that require your time. And, you know, you require, you know, money for rent and food and things like that, because I know they're not being covered. I mean, I would love to redraw that map of radio ownership, mm-hmm. because that's something which has been sort of lost since consolidation was a big, big news item. But right. Yet it's so vital to understanding how radio, but really our entire media system works, and radio being a big component of it. We get tips on some stories of things happening that will require that you can't just simply do a database query on at the FCC. That will require phone calls and shoe leather that it's difficult to find the time to do. I'd love us to be investigative so that we're not just sort of the gawker of radio working on overheard things and something. So just so people know, if we get tips, but we don't necessarily report this stuff, we can't verify it and feel as though we are bringing truth. Even though it might be something which seems on the surface, oh, you know, this will bring in hits and people, this will stir people up. But if we can't have some assurance that what we're doing is true,
right,
verifiable, that we can tell you that you can trust us, we don't want to publish that story. We don't want to create controversy where there isn't any. But if there is real controversy, we want to be sure that we are able to be factual and that we're not merely just pitting sides against each other because it gets people whipped up and excited. And we realize that's in part why we want to move away from an advertising model. So we're not dependent upon getting millions of hits, but that the people who come and read us really care, are really involved, really invested, and not looking for the quick hit. And so, I mean, that's where I want to see is to be able to pick these stories and be able to really investigate. And whether it's the three of us and Eric, or whether we have the resources to pay a super qualified freelancer,
right?
Somebody with real chops and real passion who can go do that. Because I think that's the other part of this equation for me is, you know, we at this moment, we donate our labor, right?
Right.
So what money comes in goes to paying the cost of existing. And we've been willing to do so, but there's always a clock on that. And we love people to contribute, and that's great. But the world I'm looking for is which we all kind of share in this, right? So that if someone can do that reporting and put in that time, they might be fairly compensated for their labor. I mean, it's the same principle I like to see be true for every community radio station in the country. And we know that's a tough goal. We know it's tough enough for a for-profit startup, right? And tough enough for a nonprofit or para-profit,
right.
Whatever it is we are, you know, site. But that's kind of what I would like to see. And it's part about being sustainable. But the sustainability has a purpose. Because it allows us to be sure that we can do the work, and then allows us to perhaps do deeper work than what we're currently capable of doing. Whether it's more reporting on community radio in Africa and India, which would perhaps also help these stations,
right,
be an aid to these stations, or be an aid or provide the connections with organizations or people in wealthier nations who might be able to benefit them, to be able to help them. That's kind of what I hope to see. And the podcast is part of that because it expands our audience. It expands the way we can speak with you, the listener, and speak with new listeners and spread the great word, you know, evangelize radio, I think. That's kind of answering my own question.
I'm glad you brought up some of these tips because I've had the same frustrations, you know, really juicy tips come in that I read through a long email with lots of information that I know I can't just write a story about. It's going to involve a lot of time and effort. And sadly, on some of these, I'm kind of punting and saying you might want to contact this local newspaper who's doing investigative reporting on this story because, you know, all I've done in the past, in particular with the KUSF shutdown and sale, I was doing very in-depth investigative reporting and probably the only person covering every twist and turn of that saga. But unfortunately, you know, as you mentioned, we're all volunteers, so there are only so many times when I can kind of put everything else aside,
right,
to dig deep into a story. And it's incredibly disappointing, especially since these are stories that aren't being covered.
I think it's possible, and I think people want it. I mean, I think there's an audience, and I think it's in the public interest, right? I mean, ultimately, if it isn't, then that's probably a sign I shouldn't do it. But I think it is, because these stations, whether it's an individual station like KUSF, matter dearly to so many people in San Francisco.
Yes.
Pacifica stations matter dearly to people in five cities, plus thousands, if not millions, of others who have benefited from the programming or the legacy. Every city loves its station to some extent. And then people love online. I mean, people love, whether it's a Soma FM or the people who listen to WFMU from around the world. This matters dearly, and not merely because it's entertaining, because it's informative. It's a lifeline for a lot of people. It's a reassurance that there's somebody else like you. Maybe if you're not near people who are like you, and someone else shares your values, someone else shares your desire, people share your artistic impulse, right? It cuts across all of this. And I think, you know, I guess maybe because I'm an undying optimist, that I think people want this to happen too, right? And I get it. I mean, I'm as parsimonious as the next person. And you have to think very carefully about where you put your dollar. But I also think that what we know, whether we like it or not, is that the commercial opportunity for this sort of reporting is pretty low. You know, and this is the same problem the New York Times is struggling with, right? It's not only we who are struggling. The New York Times is struggling with
what's the model?
Yeah, and NPR struggles with it as well. So we may know that we in a podcast storytelling on a part of This American Life sells pretty well, but will true investigative reporting, you know, of a sort. And that's not to slag on This American Life, which has done some great reporting, but doesn't do so on a weekly basis.
Right.
Will it sell? And it's a question. And I don't, we're not going to come up with an answer. If we had, we wouldn't be needing to be talking about it. But, you know, it's what we put out, I think, to you, the listener. And this isn't meant to be a Radio Survivor infomercial. But I thought it would be interesting for us to talk a little bit about, because I think it helps to when we forget to round back to that fundamental sort of statement of purpose, right? Why we care, why we bother to do this, why we give a crap in the first place. And I think this is a good place because it's an easy way for us to talk together more so than in print. And I really appreciate those of you stuck around to this conversation all the way through.
And you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, I really appreciated getting a chance to eavesdrop on the founders of Radio Survivor, sort of catching up and reminding themselves of what they had been up to, what you guys were doing. And did you mean to focus in on money at the end there?
No.
Was that the original plan?
No, that was it just was where the conversation went. I think it's on all of our minds.
Yep.
But it goes hand in hand with something which I think it's important for kind of anyone to do in their work, and especially for organizations and institutions to do, which is to remind themselves of their first principles, to remind themselves of the mission. It's easy to stray. It's easy to get distracted by shiny things. And I think we did some of that by sort of reminding ourselves what we were going for in the first place, and then talking about where we think we're going and what we'd like to cover. And I think because we would like this to be a sustainable operation,
right,
it was inevitable that would come up.
Yeah. To me, what it made me think of, especially the initial conversation, the first like 10 minutes or so where you guys were talking, is this idea that you came together to work on something that was extremely important to the three of you and to people, the communities that you share, and nobody was offering you a paycheck.
Correct.
And you did it anyway.
Yes.
And that's a theme that I'm holding on to in my life and noticing all the time how important that is to chase your dreams. Gosh, I wish I hadn't said it that way. But there's this strange thing where, like, if you wait for permission from a job creator to do something that you feel is important, you will certainly never do those things.
You may wait a long time, is what it is. And some people luck out, right? So I don't want to say it won't ever happen for somebody, but you may wait a long time.
Yeah. And so you guys founded something together without that promise in your free time, but now, and even then, you've noticed how important money is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've noticed how important money is, and our relative privilege in being able to do this in our free time with just a modicum of funding, so that it no longer costs us money. Right. So it does cost us time, but it right now does not cost us out of pocket. But right, we don't yet make a salary of any sort.
And I'm bringing this up because it's interesting to me. And I hope that I think it's not just about Radio Survivor. I think it's about community radio and it's about community podcasting. That question of how do you do these things that that there's no money in, or that the money is not obvious, which is a transition, perhaps. Should we transition? Can I grab the segue by the horns? So I wanted to go over something that we have gone over twice now in two episodes previous.
Okay, and let's hope people don't get tired of me yammering.
I think this might be the last time. And it's about money in podcasting.
Okay.
And the first time was your rant of show episode 14, which then was recapped in episode 15, which we also included a long interview with a podcaster who was quitting.
Mm-hmm.
And that contrast was touched upon but not delved into. And I feel like it's time, hopefully, maybe we'll be putting this particular rehashing to bed, but... Julie Sabatier shut down her podcast for the reasons detailed in that episode, and people should listen to it because it was a lot of reasons, all very well explained by Julie herself in her own voice. And I thought we needed to talk about how that's different from the individual podcaster that you didn't want to name that inspired your rant, who also shut down his podcast.
It was their attitude. It was the difference and the apparent expectations, both that were explicitly expressed and ones that were and those that were more implicit. So the guy who kind of sparked my ire that I discussed in episode 14 seemed to, if I were to characterize his tone, was, nobody's listening to my podcast. Right. Kind of like, you know, as if he were the, you know, kind of if he were number 25 in his graduating class, looking at the valedictorian going, nah, he's not so smart. People just like him better. Right. That's kind of what I read out of it, that he was doing a podcast that, to the best that I could tell of it, was nicely produced but not otherwise exceptional in its content. It was mostly him ranting about things and going over tech news.
Right, talking to himself.
Because there's not enough podcasts going over tech news.
There's one big contrast, which we can also point out, because I think it's something that makes good radio versus mediocre radio, is when people who are good at talking talk to other people who know things that they don't know.
Right.
And that's something that Julie Sabatier on her program did for roughly 9 years.
Highlighting
other
people primarily, rather than simply highlighting herself, which she barely does, in fact, although she's very good at what she does. And then he was sort of comparing himself to these podcasting gurus. Who sort of walk that line between get rich quick scheme and being truly sincere and trying to help people to podcast. So I don't want to call them out as get rich pyramid scheme builders.
Right.
But there are these podcasters like John Lee Dumas, called the entrepreneur on fire.
Because there's one way to make money in podcasts, and it's to sell the idea of podcasting to
And there's another guy who runs kind of podcasts. Who's been doing like the school of podcasting, something like that. But he's been doing it for 10 years. So I can't imagine it was very lucrative 10 years ago. So I don't really mean to criticize him directly, because I think also he puts out a lot of great free material. And if you read his stuff, you'll learn quite a bit. Maybe those guys can make some money. Right. But there's no, you know, but, you know, I think I've been sold a bill of goods is basically what he implied.
Right. And there's nobody who is doing that, saying you should start a community radio program and make money. And that's how Julie started her work. Is she, the whole time it's been a community radio program that also happened to, have an RSS feed.
Yeah. And then it slowly turned into more of a podcast, which happened to sometimes be on the radio. But
and another, those of us from that world know never to expect too much of a paycheck for our time.
Well, and then I think it is also that expectation, because again, I'm going to have to, the implicit thing from this other guy was that he was expecting to make a living, maybe make a great living at podcasting. And I don't want to say you can't or won't.
Don't quit your day job.
Right. Podcasters. Just like you can make a living being a stand-up comedian. You can make a living being an actor.
A professional musician. A
professional musician. All of these things I think are sort of comparable. And what I understood from Julie, I don't want to put words in her mouth, is what she really wanted was for her show to be sustainable.
Right.
And she had gone so far as to pay everyone else who worked on her show but did not pay herself. Because she did not feel as I'm proposing right. that she did not feel as though she had to be paid,
right.
but that the work of getting that income, the kickstarting, the Indiegogo campaigns and all of those things was draining and of course taking her away from podcasting. So, you know, I think it was and what I didn't hear from her and what she, I don't think she said to us was, I'm quitting because I'm not making any money.
Right.
But that this whole mass of factors, which includes making her program sustainable.
Right.
From a monetary standpoint, led her to quit.
Yeah.
And,
I think she
and,
did.
She and
did
she
say,
didn't seem put out.
Right. She did say, I believe, that there were two hills to climb.
Yes.
That were right in front of her face, that she could see them coming at her. And it wasn't to get her – it wasn't even to make her mm-hmm. the paycheck. It was to make the paycheck for the people she needed on her staff. And even those hills seemed a bit too much to think about all at once.
And that was very fair, right? Yeah. And I admire that she produced her show with such integrity and respect for other people's labor and time.
Right.
Because it's very easy to say, oh, I'm the producer and I'm volunteering all my time, so everyone else ought to as well. And I'm not going to say that I look down on that or that's wrong, so much is that she took a much harder road, and I think that deserves quite a bit of respect. I think she gets respect from me for taking that road. She didn't seem selfish right? And so maybe selfish in that she's looking out for herself in leaving the program, right? And understanding that maybe this is it for her for the time. But I never got a sense from her the entire time she was with us that she was put out
right.
or that she was bitter. She seemed liberated.
Yeah. So that's an interesting contrast between those two podcasters shutting down their shows
yeah.
for similar reasons, but in a way in which one we have the utmost respect for and the other inspired you to rant.
Yes. And I sort of expand on this idea a little bit in a post that went live recently. It's called Love Every Listener.
Right.
And I will put it in the show notes so that you can read it. It's not about that guy who still remains nameless or about Julie, but it's about this idea, I think, that they've been developing over the last few shows of how lucky we are to have an audience, whether we're a community radio broadcaster or a podcaster, and why I think recognizing that is important for us. So I'll leave it at that and let you go ahead and read that.
Well, up next on this program, we're going to try something. It's not new. It's an idea that I had. Well, it starts here. I've been, I'm not good at small talk out in the world. And I tried something new because of this work that we are doing, because of this podcast we produce, this radio program, asking people what they like. Strangers, what do you listen to? What kind of podcast do you like? And I had a really fun conversation with a clerk at a costume shop and apparel place on Hawthorne Boulevard here in Portland, where she had some wonderful opinions about podcasts that I'd never heard of before.
Okay, cool.
And what was neat about it was the thing that she liked. I was like, what kind of podcast do you like? And she's like, oh, comedy podcasts. And I was like, well, of course, everyone loves comedy podcasts. But then she also likes horror movie podcasts. And that delighted me, because here is a subgenre that I can respect. And of course it exists. And I had never thought of it. I had never once listened to a horror movie podcast. No. And so I dove in. She recommended two.
Okay.
And I listened to an episode of both of them. And then I went ahead and listened to, about four or five other horror movie podcasts and got a sense of what they're like. And in the process of listening to all these shows, came up with some ideas that I want to talk to you about.
And about how many horror movie podcasts do you think there are in total?
Dozens.
Dozens.
And if not more, because this is, well, step one, how do you find things you don't know about? Mm-hmm. You know, I know there's horror movie podcasts. Well, one, I talked to this lady who was very generous and shared with me her opinions. And so she recommended Forever Midnight and Trash Video Podcast. So that was one way to find out about a podcast you've never heard of, is ask somebody. The next thing I did was I went to iTunes and clicked on through the top charts until I got to film and video, and then scanned the hundreds of podcasts under film and video and selected out the ones that were
right
horror movie related. And so the number 115 as of last week on the film and video chart of iTunes is Bloody Good Horror.
Okay.
So as far as I can tell, that might be the most popular.
So big in the iTunes charts, at least.
Yeah.
For whatever that's worth.
And I went on down the list. And then the other thing you can do, which I did do, is go to iTunes and just search horror under podcasts. And some of the similar ones to the charts come up, but then some new ones came up as well. And after that, I stopped. Okay. I can think of other ways to find podcasts, but now I had too many.
Mm-hmm.
Googling would be the other thing that I did not do.
Right.
Horror podcasts. And then I learned some things about these shows.
Please share.
Well, one, I have a blanket statement that I'm ready to make.
Okay.
There's two kinds of podcasts in the world. There's drunk podcasts and caffeinated podcasts. There's podcasts where the hosts get drunk and hang out, and there's podcasts where the hosts drink coffee.
And there's a third, Mormon podcast, where they may drink neither caffeine nor alcohol.
The third one are the religious podcasts that I haven't gotten to
well,
yet.
But Mormons, other religions are allowed to have coffee or tea. Mormons are specific, no tea, no coffee, and no alcohol.
So a lot of the podcasts that I came across under the horror movie genre are drinking podcasts. Clearly, they talk about the booze that they're consuming at the beginning of the show.
Right.
Which is also a style of podcasting that is dudes hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
More than two dudes, but they're all men, having a good time, joking a lot, not being focused.
Right.
Going off on tangents, telling stories, but also making each other laugh.
Right. And in the description, it's always, and whatever random thing that comes to mind.
And this is causing me to rant, because I'm actually, if anyone is ever going to listen to my advice about podcasting, I would ask these people to tone it down.
Yeah.
And have fun and make each other laugh. But I don't know. Maybe they should hang out with their – maybe it's fine. Maybe they should hang out with their friends and drink and record things, and that's just not for me.
It depends on their objective, right? I mean, if it's meeting their current objectives, why not?
But Bloody Good Horror, which could very well be the most popular horror movie podcast there is, according to the iTunes charts, is an example of that. And they also, the men who host that podcast, did a good job of having segments.
Yeah.
They focused on those segments. They did talk about horror movies. They clearly have an audience. They actually have a relatively successful Patreon page that I checked out. But they also wasted a lot of time making each other laugh about things that weren't horror movie related. Which brings me to another point about podcasting that I learned by doing this sample, is that it's hard to understand what a podcast series is by jumping in to the most recent episode.
Hmm.
I don't have a clue who these guys are. I don't have a clue what they're up to. And I have the sense, listening to the most recent episode, that their audience has been on board for a while and is either willing to give them the benefit of the doubt and learn who they are by listening to more than one episode, or it's possible they were doing a better job of welcoming new listeners earlier.
Probably. And I know people who jump into podcasts at number one. They don't start in the middle. They right. start at number one, provided it's available.
Yeah, provided it's available.
Yeah.
I didn't try that out. I just listened to some of the most recent. But it made me realize that if anyone's listening to me about podcasting advice, it's start with the meat of your show and then have the joking, funny, teasing stuff happen after you've let new listeners into what you're up to.
It lets that new listener kind of have something to grab onto, or even an old listener perhaps puts up with the joking and the teasing in order to get to the meat, and you'll super serve them by putting it up at the front.
Yeah. So other things that I learned, I really actually subscribed. I found a podcast that I want to hear again called the, I hope I pronounce this right, Horretic Podcast.
I think that's supposed to be horror, et cetera.
Horror, et cetera.
Didn't they say the name in the podcast?
You know, that might have been, I'm not sure if that's my oversight or theirs. It's spelled horror and then without a space, ETC at the end. What I liked about this podcast is this is the caffeinated version of talking about horror films and books, not the drunken version. And that leads me to another insight about the kinds of podcasts I like, which is, and it doesn't matter if it's about horror or if it's about radio or if it's about something else, I prefer intellectuals who don't mind talking about ideas. You know, there's lots of smart podcasts, and I like those better. And this was one of them, Horror Etc. That's what I'm going to call it, even though I'm not sure now, is one of those podcasts. They talk
on the website, it says Horror Space ETC.
Ah, so they just did it wrong on iTunes.
Yeah.
So great show where two individuals who are, you know, and the third insight is I believe they're writers. And if they're not writers, they're readers. Mm-hmm. And they talk like writers.
And I didn't realize how much of a passion you had for the subject material. The Island of Dr. Moreau.
I love this story. I grew up on the film from the 70s, which we'll get into its pros and cons now. But, you know, I grew up on that movie just loving every minute of it. And there's always been something that has appealed to me about anytime they can take a horror film and use it to have that discussion of what is a human being and what is a man. I love Frankenstein. I love The Wolfman. I love The Island of Dr. Moreau. They all tackle this same subject in their own way.
I also learned that more women need to podcast and more men need to make the effort to include women in their shows. A lot of this, as you might imagine, in the horror genre is men talking to men about man things with men stuff. Mm-hmm. And my ears perked up and I was so delighted. Trash Video, for instance, the one that the woman who was the clerk at the store was a fan of, Trash Video, happens to be a man and a woman who I think work at a video store talking to one another. And that made me really happy that there was a woman talking about horror movies on a podcast. That show is also of note. The production values are weirdly high. There are sketches. There are radio sketches that are really dumb, but still unique.
This seems like one I would like. So I'm not. I was into horror movies when I was a teenager, but I sort of grew out of it. Never kind of got back into it. But I have this great affection for old video.
Yeah, VHS.
VHS and the really trashy aesthetic. And, you know, really low budget, straight to video, that's, you know, grungy and you know, where they do the best they can with the effects.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to play clips from this one for you, Paul.
Okay.
We're finally at number one.
Yeah.
Evil Ed, the ending. When our hero with a shotgun, Evil Ed, comes in with a scalpel. He's got our hero's girlfriend strapped down to a table, about ready to kill her. Our hero comes in with a shotgun, points it at him, and goes, "Rest in pieces, mother." blast Evil Ed in the well, first of all, before that was said, he gets him in the stomach and then he blows his arm off, so you got like an armless bloody Evil Ed, and then rest in peace, and just you, I mean, it's almost like you can see just like the pellets going into Evil Ed's head and blowing it off against the wall. And it is, I wore out my VHS tape watching that. I mean, I'm sure you can go back and it'd just be tracking issues all over that segment. Just like, oh my God, this is the best ever. You know, when I think of, and that is also, I'll go back to like a lead up, you know, the whole movie's led up to this point, and then, you know, that's our ending shot. That's what this whole
right
came to. And it's very satisfying.
One thing that's hilarious is them talking about re-watching the scene at the end, the big climactic death scene at the end of a VHS tape in his teens, and ruining the tape so that VHS...
so it doesn't play right anymore, yeah.
Another thing that they do on the Trash Video Podcast, which I think was funny, is... they let it go the way all podcasts do, talking about stuff they don't know about, the research that they have not yet done. But when they get it wrong on the fly, someone in post-production is sounding a buzzer.
That's
and,
great.
And if they get it right on their speculation, someone in post-production is hitting the applause button. So I think what they're doing is they're going through their podcast, I'm going to assume, Googling... for the answer, not Googling within the body of the recording, because wow, doesn't mm-hmm. that kill the conversation, but Googling after the fact and then letting listeners know through that auditory signal that yes, we were wrong, or no, we were right, which I thought was really unique. I like that idea.
Now, most of these shows, do they mostly take the format of discussing a single film or maybe a series of films per episode? It seems to me, I'm just looking through at their websites, that seems to be the basic approach, although maybe they're off and thematic.
Yeah, they do different stuff. So the episode of Trash Video that I really enjoyed, the two hosts, the man and the woman, they shared a top 10 list of death scenes.
I see.
That
hence
they enjoyed.
Why he wore that one out.
Yeah. And on the Bloody Good Horror episode that I listened to, they nominally were focusing on a new horror movie that actually their Patreon subscribers had requested they focus on. But really, the whole thing was just this freeform, nebulous conversation about pop culture.
But I want to point out that that show is into like well over 370 episodes.
Yeah, and they sounded good. I think that it might... You know, if you're going to study how podcasts succeed, I think Bloody Good Horror might have had the best on mic sound.
And I think it's worth pointing out that they have 376 episodes.
Right.
I think there's something to longevity.
They know what they're doing.
That gives people an opportunity to dive in and really get to know them. So maybe if the audience, a new audience, isn't quite able to get the hook on the first one they listen to, if they're intrigued enough,
right,
over time, they're really getting to know these hosts. Because part of what they say about podcasting is sort of like eavesdropping on conversations. And if you like the people, right, then it's really great. And that, I mean, that's also like a little bit of talk radio.
But it's strange because with that, when you do that on the radio, you stand a chance of having someone tune in again by accident.
Right.
And when you do that on podcasts, it's like, oh, I've heard that one.
And it looks like people are. So,
so what do I know?
It's not a criticism of you. I mean, it's not what do you know? I think it's interesting for us to take that into account.
Right. Well, I just mean that I don't plan on listening to Bloody Good Horror again unless as an academic exercise to try to figure out if I want to like it. Well, meanwhile, some of these other ones I will check out.
I wonder if you might listen to it more if you were a hardcore horror fan.
Yeah, good question.
Like, so if because I think one attraction is, oh, that's kind of like when me and my buddies, you know, get together on a Thursday or Friday night, drink a bunch of beer, and watch the movie.
Right. So Horror Etc., the one where they seem a little more coffee and a little less booze, they had a conversation about Island of Dr. Moreau, the films, which are horror films, but it was grounded in a reading of the H.G. Wells book, and which is basically a world that I will podcast, that I will consume as a podcast listener all the time. Genre fiction, mm-hmm. and horror genre and sci-fi genre is something that I'm willing to wait people out. So maybe that's why that one's my favorite.
Also, I think so.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I think it's part of that accessibility question you always have to think about whenever you make any sort of niche media, is that the accessibility is good because it can bring in new people. But sometimes building that sort of insider club in a way, Howard Stern.
Right.
You could listen to Howard Stern for the first time, and if you don't get a celebrity interview and you can't figure out what it means when you hear the sample, Baba Booey. You're like, what is this? It makes no sense, right?
Right.
So
makes sense.
It's a little bit of getting that insider perspective as well, but it's a balance. And I think you might have to make that investment of 300 episodes to build that, and that it would be hard to expect to have that after 25 or 30. And I noticed that I think the one you like the best, which is Horror, Etc. Horror, Etc. So they're into 370 episodes.
Yeah, I'm going to take a listen to more. So one of the last things I want to remark upon in my journey through horror podcasts is one of the podcasts that I discovered by searching the search bar in iTunes and typing in horror and seeing what came up was an oldie, which I love that there are old podcasts now. And this one, it'd be fun to reach out to the producer and find out what happened. They retired it, and without explanation. I listened to the most recent episode, and it was from 2006.
Oh, yes.
And the producer's name is Ellen, and without a last name.
No last name, unidentified.
And what I liked about this show was it's this style of podcasting, which I've heard it's still around, but it's not as popular as the rest. It's the fully scripted monologue.
Oh, wow.
She is a writer who's reading her work out loud.
So it's like Dan Carlin more so.
Yeah. Another one that Ernesto Aguilar recommended when he was on the program that is under that format is Congressional Dish.
Yes.
The author of that podcast is clearly reading her work, which is funny. It's a bit of a throwback, but it works.
If you're good at it,
yeah.
If you're good at it, it really does work.
And what I liked about Ellen's podcast, Dark Gate Horror Podcast from the previous decade of podcasting, was that her work was very well researched. Mm-hmm. And so instead of these drunken bros hanging out who love movies, shooting the crap, Ellen was digging into the archives of the things that she was talking about and speaking from experience. And maybe that's why she liked having it scripted.
And maybe it was difficult to sustain because that's it's a lot more work to script things out and to do it that way than it is to just BS on the mic.
Yep. Yes.
So thank you. I mean, that's interesting. It's an interesting way to kind of dig deep into a subject in which you might have some interest but are not a fan or not yet, you know, totally peaked. I'm interested now to hear – in particular, I want to hear the trash video. That sounds completely up my alley because I'm a obsolete technology fetishist, I would say. And it is only because I moved across the country that there aren't piles of VHS tapes and laser discs in this room.
There's a subculture that reminds me of radio stations, the video store, the DVD video rental store.
We can't even go there.
It's something, though.
It is something. It is something.
It's a link to the past. It's a world of intellectual pursuits. There's a community. It serves a body of customers who are either listeners or members or...
There are now guys shooting and releasing new horror movies on VHS.
Yeah.
Just going to put that out there. Just like, you know, the world's biggest cassette factory in Missouri is now working, you know, 24/7 swing shifts and the whole deal to catch up with demand. I'm just going to put that out there. Although we're recording this on a computer and we'll distribute this on MP3. There is very little obsolete techno fetishism going on in this room. So I think this could go on forever, Eric. That's me. That's a criticism of me.
Yeah.
So I think we have to thank everybody for bearing with us on this conversation. We hope you enjoyed it. If you didn't, let us know.
No, if you did and you have a VHS tape you want to tell us about, let us know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Either which way, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And that brings to close this edition of Radio Survivor. As I just mentioned, please tell us what you think. We always like to hear from you. podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And please do subscribe to the podcast in your favorite podcast listening application so you can get it automatically downloaded every single week. It goes live Tuesdays, every single Tuesday. If you use iTunes, please subscribe there. And if you have a chance, give us a review. Click some stars. That helps other people find the program. And if you can't afford to support us, we'd really appreciate it. As you heard in this show, right now it is an all-volunteer labor of love for radio. Even $1 a month will really help us continue to produce the show and everything we do at RadioSurvivor.com. Go to patreon.com/RadioSurvivor. On behalf of myself, Paul Riesmandel, and my co-host and co-producer, Eric Klein, we thank you so much for taking the time to listen to our show.